Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffeegrande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
Hey, this is Gordo. You're listening to Those Conspiracy Guys. And this is a little interview/swapcast with the man himself, Kevin Long. You would never have heard of him. He's traipsing around the streets of Munich, pointing out Hitler shit all over the place. And we managed to find him through a tour booking. I was like, show me them Hitler goods, Munich. And lo and behold, this Claire man loomed over the horizon with a head full of facts. And we ended up chatting. And you know the way the Irish lads do. Whenever we find each other, we're all like, how'd you get here? Is there any jobs going? And I ended up saying, look, do you want to come and join us for a chat about Hitler? And he fucking nearly took the hand off me. So we're chatting with Kevin in a beer garden in the middle of München. People all around. So you'll hear the sights and sounds and smells of the city. So excuse the audio quality because we were flying by the seat of our trousers. I do apologise for the lack of quote-unquote real episodes right now, but we are on a trip around Europe for those that are not in the know, gathering up all these videos, interviews, podcasts, swapcasts, and little kind of mini-docs, as well as first-hand research into a bunch of stuff that's coming up in Season 8 and Season 9, including more Nazis, a World War II series, standalone World War II series, ancient European history. We're talking 1,200 years ago. I want to do an episode on Leonardo da Vinci. We're going to do one on the Medici's Whopper. I'm actually preparing right now in a hotel room in Barcelona to do an interview / swapcast with a man who's an expert on Catalonian history, which is amazing. And yeah, Europe is opening itself up like a flower to me here, having a really good time learning all this new stuff and getting to meet these people. And this is one of those. This is Kevin Long, who's a tour guide in Munich, an expert in Nazi history, early Nazi history. And if you want to get in touch with Kevin, it's kevylong@hotmail.com. We'll say it again at the end if you miss it. And if you have anything you want to say to me, we're on all the social media. Send me an email, info@thoseconspiracyguys. And if you like what you hear and you want to hear more, patreon.com/thoseconspiracyguys. That's it from me. I hope you enjoyed this little episode and reach out to Kevin and tell him if you like it. Please do. He's dying to hear from you. Okay, here's the swapcast. Goodbye.
Hitler, Roswell, JFK, cryptozoology and NSA, global warming and 11 government lies. Tell them all about it, those conspiracy guys.
Hello, we're coming live from Munich Town, Germany, and joining me after a foot blisteringly long but awesome walking tour of Munich, I have Kevin Long out in the beer garden here. Where are we, Kevin?
We're at the Park Café.
Park Café, the former
SS Gentleman's Club, which was founded in 1937.
And we were inside, and it still smells like Bavarian strippers, I have to say. There's a distinct stench of want, or as we know it in German, Möchte. just bang a Möchte off the place. So, Kevin, you're a tour guide in Germany, in Munich. Tell us, how did you get here?
I am indeed, yes. I mean, fairly by chance, to be told. So, I mean, I studied history and economics back in University of Limerick. And I finished that in 2013. Now, initially, my first summer in Munich was in 2012. And what happened there with that was I was looking for somewhere to go for the summer.
For the ride?
Well, for the ride and the experience and the crack. And sure. So just to see what was out there, but mainly for the ride, naturally.
You wanted to see if your time in Limerick drinking beer was transferable with credits over to Germany.
Sadly, it wasn't. It wasn't, sadly. But that's we figured that eventually over time. And I came out and issued one lad from college, and we worked in a beer garden. It's called the Chinese Tower Beer Garden. It's one of the second biggest in the world, actually. It's right bang in the middle of the park in Munich called the English Garden. And we worked there for the summer, and I poured beer, and there's about 40 Irish students. And we ended up having one of those amazing summers, like a coming-of-age movie. And then I went back, and I finished a degree, and...
American Pie job.
A little bit like that. So how we used to work...
Just with more...
quickly. So how
more
we used
soft
to work,
pretzels.
We work in the beer gardens. A lot of us, we work 12, 13 hours, and we go drinking out then most nights. And we were all staying at a place called The Tent, which was initially started as an outdoor youth hostel for the 72 Olympics. So to kind of paint the picture, if you will, you had a series of marquee tents, circus tents, so to say. And a few of them had bunk beds. And then all the Irish, we got a bunch of blankets, and we slept on the floor. We paid about €7 a night for the privilege.
And the place mysteriously smelled like the sea.
It smelled very similar to the inside of the Park Cafe, actually. You got kind of want.
The Bangamurta.
That want and the desire and the mishta for mishta that you can't really find anywhere else.
You can find it in some places if you look hard enough.
There's a distinctive smell over there.
And there was a lot of people came over from lots of places all over the world, right?
All over Ireland. So there was a bunch of girls from Trinity. There was lads from UCC. There was a few from Galway. And we just had a great summer. And then I went back and finished the degree. And after finishing that, I kind of said to myself, well, listen, I don't really know what I want to do. But I kind of knew myself I didn't want to, you know, go down a career for the sake of it. I said, listen, we'll go back to Germany. We'll see what it's like. And if it works out great, if it doesn't, you know, it's not like you're stuck out in New Zealand. It's only 2.5 hour flight home. And it did. It worked out. So shortly after joining, I eventually became a tour guide. I kind of fell into that as well. Started that. And I just took to it. I enjoyed it.
Seemed like an entertainer.
I always wanted a bit of a class clown in school, you know, and really what happened there was I had the background in history and I started it and I just enjoyed it. And I took to it really like kind of like a duck to water. And for me as well, like I remember early on when I just said to myself, listen, if you're going to do this, you might as well try and be the best that you can do. Even if you're going to go do it for a year or two. Now, granted, it's been 6 years of tour guide, which I never expected. But I said, listen, if I'm going to do it, let's do it properly. So I invested myself in learning as much as I could. And like with regards to, for example, a lot of the Nazi history, I mean, I had a background in it already. I'd studied quite a bit of that at college, amongst other things. And so half of that I knew. So in a way, I was ahead of the curve to begin with. And then I kind of dedicated myself over the first year or two to really learning as much as I know and becoming an expert on Munich. And then from there, you know, in the last year and a half, I've become a freelance tour guide and I'm doing a lot, much wider variety of tours. I'm doing day trips to Nuremberg. Tomorrow I go down to the Neuschwanstein Castle, the famous Disney castle. And
yeah, I saw the tour of that. There was like €450 to bring somebody down there for the day. And you're like, do you fucking give them a blow in the back of the bus or something? Like, what the fuck are you doing?
King Ludwig does. The king himself does. Yeah, they resurrect
like
him.
A nine-story castle on the top of like a basalt fucking pillar out in the middle of the thing.
Yeah.
And there's two. There's one at, what's it called?
Neuschwanstein.
And there's another one that begins with L.
Linderhof,
he didn't finish.
Linderhof, he did finish.
Right.
That was the only one he did finish. He also had another one called Herrenchiemsee, which was to be a model on the Palace of Versailles.
Right.
And the Hall of Mirrors there is actually 3 meters longer than the one in the Palace of Versailles.
That's the fellow with the fucking short penis complex.
Exactly. Well, he was an interesting character. But the funny thing is, he had vision.
He was the mad Ludwig.
He was mad Ludwig, yeah. But Ludwig had vision because, you know what? While he was despised at the time, he's now the most celebrated king. And it's because of one wonderful concept known as tourism.
Right.
It's now the most visited building in all of southern Germany.
So let's see how people think about Donald Trump in 200 or 300 years' time when people are visiting Trump Tower and just being like, here we have the famous Trump Tower. At the time, it was garish and kind of reviled. It was a testament to his own ego. But do you know what? It's fucking lovely. I think that could happen.
It could well happen.
Mad King Donald. So you were a history major.
I was.
For all the Americans, I think.
Yeah.
And what was your favorite part of history studying?
My favorite part of history was probably the later modern period. Okay. So I'd say from kind of 1800 up to kind of 1950. But I would say more specifically, I'd say more focus really on the first 100 years rather than the second 50. For my personal interest, I always had more of an interest, a little bit more of an interest in World War I than I had necessarily in World War II. Because I was always of the opinion that you couldn't really understand World War II without understanding World War I. You also couldn't really understand World War I without understanding the French Revolution, Napoleonic Wars, and the link between them all. So I think
there's massively complicated geopolitical stuff going on before World War I.
Hugely so.
But there's stuff that's left out, like economic machinations of a brand new America, and England that's maybe trying to wind down a really vast and overspread imperialist
while
rule.
Keeping as much power as possible.
Exactly. So they're all looking at Germany, who's just like, to be honest, and I say it on the show like a joke, like Germany didn't really do a whole lot wrong apart from the whole, you know, killing people that shouldn't be killed or whatever. Like, they had it really sewn up, and these Americans and English, I think, were a little bit jealous. World War One, as far as we learned in our Monsanto episode and in Big Pharma, we have done a couple episodes, that World War One was really like a pharmaceutical war. It was to create the demand for antiseptic, which is just newly invented, and to take away the means of production for Germans in creating these new pharmacological products that had never been on the market before. And America's like, they're making a shitload of money off of this. How do we, first of all, disable them and then take over the production for ourselves? And with the movement of IG Farben and into like Bayer and all that stuff, that are now quintessentially American companies, you can see that like it's a 100-year plan to just take over pharmacology. So to understand stuff like that, you really have to know the 100 years before. Like,
absolutely. And even the period before that. Now, I think with World War One, I think I definitely see your point there in regards to the pharmaceutical war. I would maybe more so it was more of an industrial war, of which pharmaceutical was a large part of.
Yeah, I mean,
you had a very strong German industry coming to the fore. And of course, the thing is, Germany, let's say in the 50 years before World War One, Germany is very much the new player of Europe. You know, there is no Germany before 1871. You have a series of kingdoms, you have principalities. You know, by the time Germany is unified, you have actually 35 different states that all come together. Now, Germany, with regards to World War One, I think what Germany's problem was there was they kind of overextended themselves a little bit. And Bismarck, when he unifies Germany, it's not really unification. It's kind of a conquest. Now, Bismarck was a very clever man. And of course, he provokes the French into declaring war. And you have the Franco-Prussian War. And Berlin is eventually takes over Paris. You know, Paris is taken by the Germans. Yeah. The German Empire is declared at Versailles. Now, if Bismarck is still alive, if Bismarck is immortal, I think everything would have worked out fine.
Yeah.
Because he was a very good diplomat.
Had his handle on it.
He had his handle on everything, you know. But Bismarck made the fatal mistake of aligning himself with Austria in 1879. And that, I think, was... Then, from then onwards, then everything kind of gets kind of set in stone slowly, you know. Because Germany's very conscious of an Austrian-Russian war. And the reason was this. Bismarck was from Prussia. Prussia was, you know, modern-day northern Poland, a little part of Russia that is in the middle of Europe, northern, you know, northeastern Germany, Berlin, the capital, whatever. And there was Protestant Prussia, and they held the power. They controlled the army, they controlled all the government jobs, and the rest of Germany was really, in many ways, kind of second in the line to Prussia. Prussia's needs with German needs, essentially. Germany's oriented around Prussia. And he was worried, essentially, that if Russia was to declare war in Austria, the Russians could win. And if the Russians win, more than likely, your Austrians would have moved into Germany. And the problem was, you would have had about 8 million Catholics moving into Germany. And all of a sudden, your balance of power is totally changed.
Yeah.
And your voting changes, and your parliament changes. And Bismarck would not have been able to keep Prussia to the forefront. Germany would have become a probably more unified concept, and it would have been less centralized around Prussia and more so around the south of the country and the west of the country. Because the reality of it is, the wealth in Germany during this time, during the early days of the German Empire and up until World War One, was very much in the west of the country, around the Rhineland. That's where all your major industries were. Yeah. It's where your steel and coal was. And the money that's being extracted from there is going filtering over to Berlin. Because East Prussia at this stage, in the 1850s, you have the Ostflut, which is essentially the Eastern migration, where you have about 200,000 people a year leaving from, you know, what was East Prussia, East Germany, into the Rhineland in particular. And they settled in towns like Dortmund and Gelsenkirchen. And these are big industrial towns. And it was 200,000 a year for about 10 years before it was finally put to a stop. And in many ways, the same thing cropped up again in East Germany. That's why the wall goes up.
That was a big thing that I felt from our tour, that parallels that you were drawing, like pre-war and post-war. It seems like West and East Germany have always kind of been split. And what I wanted to say to you on the tour, when you asked any questions, I was like, I'm fucking wrecking this lad's jaws. And all these Americans are like, my feet hurt. Sydney, can we go? Like, it was a little, you know, I didn't want to be annoying you.
Yeah.
But it felt like that maybe post-World War One, that East Germany was kind of more punished
than West, and definitely after World War II, because the East were more in support of the Nazi Party. Mm-hmm. They were definitely like exorcised.
Yeah.
In a kind of a new division of Germany, back to the old way before unification.
Mm-hmm.
And they just left the East to be swallowed up by the Soviets, mm-hmm. and like poor infrastructure, poor... Mm-hmm. There's an ambulance, sorry. We're out in the open. Poor infrastructure, poor... industry, like, it was all, nothing was available. You were queuing up for shit, like, you know, typical Soviet stuff.
But I think that was exacerbated too, because there wasn't a whole lot of industry in Prussia to begin with.
Yeah.
You had a massive landowning class called the Junkers. And you got to understand too, with the settlement in East Prussia, it was never really, you know, your historical vision of Germany will say during the Charlemagne era and Otto the Great and all these various kind of, you know, German emperors in the from 800 up until about 1400, your typical Germany wasn't that far east. You know, there were settlers that went in during the Teutonic Knights, you know, the times, and they came in and essentially military forces that came over and they conquered it. And you had this massive landowning class, and you have also, the population is not entirely German. It's about 50-50 between the Germans and the Polish.
And the Polish have that kind of history of being passed around like a bitch, like, in prison.
Totally, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. You know,
the Swedish came down and yeah. the Nazis were around, yeah. the Russians were around. Yeah. Even Austro-Hungarian Empire yeah. like took all that shit.
Yeah.
So they never really had that identity. And we were in Auschwitz like last week, and the Polish guide that was bringing us around like really wanted to make a point of the fact that it was like... These were German camps on Polish soil, and that we don't want them called Polish, and Poland was only in 1989 made a real country. Like, it's still raw for them.
It's still raw. It's very raw.
And we were in Berlin there, and then on the east side of Berlin, like, you walk across two streets and it changes from east to west, like, mm-hmm. visibly, mm-hmm. financially, physically, yeah. like, you can feel it in the air yeah. that it's different. Like, that's a huge division that still resonates like 70 years
ago. Hugely so. I mean, but even
the checkpoint charity mentality, like,
even today, for example, I mean, when Germany was unified in 1990, there was a tax brought in. It was the reunification tax, and it was 2.5%. It was meant to last for 3 years. It's still in place.
Shit.
It's still in place, you know, and that's a tax that comes from old West Germany that goes towards the betterment of East Germany. And again, so I like to make the comparison, for example. And we're both Irish. And when you go, as soon as you cross the border into Northern Ireland,
yeah.
you know straight away it's different.
Yeah, you get Buckfast for £6.
Yeah, well, but it even looks That's different as well. It doesn't look what you're kind of used to, we'll say, in the Republic. And it's very same when you go to East Germany.
Lads with ascots and fucking yeah. tweed waistcoats, lovely yeah. shiny buttons, and like the walking sticks with the roundy tops to bait tigers with. Like, it is very different.
It is completely different.
But even the architecture, the way they have all the purely manicured gardens and all yeah. this stuff, it's a very British kind of aesthetic.
Very much so.
Here in Munich, I see that it's not as it was in Berlin, or even when we were traveling. From Berlin, we went to Oschwitz and then to Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and then across Vienna, Salzburg, and then into yeah. Munich. So, like... It's more like a Salzburg type of architecture.
It is very much so.
Very Austrian architecture.
Munich is also, the thing is too, in Germany, I mean, because in Germany you have so many states that were independent for such a long time, mm. that the culture of Berlin is very different to Cologne, which is very different to Munich as well. You know, Cologne, for example, is very much influenced by the French, if only because of the fact that they're so close to the French border. There's a lot more influence there than you would have, say, in Munich or Berlin. Munich's got a lot of influence with Italy.
Yeah.
The royal family in Munich, the von Wittelsbachs, actually married quite a few Italian duchesses and countesses, and that was very much the link into Munich. So you see a lot of Munich building-wise, architecturally, can look quite similar to Italy. But there's also a lot of that typical mountain architecture. You know, Munich is essentially the foothills of the Alps.
Yeah.
And it is, they very much identify as a mountain people, even in Munich, even though this is not a high elevation. I think we're only 600 and something odd meters above sea level, but it's right there. And it's always been Bavaria historically, which is the largest of the 16 states in Germany. It used to be a lot smaller. It used to be very much concentrated in a mountain area. I mean, historically, the divisions, the border, would have gone about 50 kilometers north of Munich.
Yeah.
During, let's say, the medieval ages and the early modern period. Now it's a lot bigger. Now it's the biggest state. But
that's just urban sprawl. Like, there's more people here, so you need more space. Is that it?
No, insofar as, well, that was with Napoleon. The territory was made a lot bigger. And now it encompasses areas, we'll say, that would have historically not identified as Bavaria.
Right.
But now they are part of it. But within the city itself, There is urban sprawl, but Munich seems to have quite a grip on it. You know, Munich is a size of a city. I mean, it's 1.5 million people, which I quite like. I personally find it to be a good size of a city.
Yeah, it's that.
You know, it's
Dublin sized.
Just Dublin sized, completely Dublin sized. You know, but I mean, it's
Dublin sized in people, but Dublin, geographically way bigger, right?
Yeah, it is. It is great. It's quite large, exactly. It is. But Dublin too, you have a lot of concentration towards the city centre. Whereas here as well in Munich, you see, they actually have a rule in Munich. The cathedral is called the Frauenkirche, and it's 99 meters tall. And for centuries, they've said that no building is allowed to exceed that in the city.
Was that the Ludwig lad who made that rule with the small dick?
No, that was the Catholic Church who made that rule. Okay. They also small had small dicks as well. Yeah, they did.
Have small dicks, love small dicks. You know, it's all about dicks. And for Munich then as a city, like to modernize as it has, we were talking about Hitler on the tour. Like it got absolutely decimated during World War II because it was the ideological center.
Exactly, the symbolic heart, you could say.
Of National Socialism. Mm-hmm. So like on your tour, you showed us a couple of like places that were bombed out and that were remade. And a very interesting thing that I did not know was that they kept the blueprints of München and rebuilt it with the money that the Americans were giving for like reformation.
Yep.
They rebuilt it identically to what it was before. Exactly. Like, that's amazing.
It is. It is quite amazing and quite unique within Germany.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of places that did that.
Like, why do you think for something that was the ideological center of National Socialism, if you had the opportunity to like to get rid of that kind of memory, why wouldn't you take it? Because that seems to rebuild it exactly the same is that not?
But I think and you saw this. I mean, you would have seen quite a few buildings on tour related to the Nazi regime which did survive, and a lot of them were quite important buildings. So the reality of it is, a lot of the buildings that were destroyed or were damaged had a history far previous to the Nazi era, and I think in Munich, because Munich had quite a proud history of its own, and because it was the capital city of an independent state and kingdom for many years, that if you were to do away with all of that history and turn it into completely modern history, you would in many ways be removing Bavarian history from this society. And then all of a sudden it's no longer Bavarian, then it's just another German city.
Right.
And in Munich, the concept of being Bavarian is very important to the people. They very much identify Munich, not so much as the countryside, but they very much identify it as being firstly Bavarian. So when you think of nomenclatures of Germanic culture, you think of Lederhosen. Now, Lederhosen is very much a southern German Austrian thing. You won't see that up in Berlin. Now, don't get me wrong, you'll see lots of men wearing
tourist shops.
You'll see lots of men wearing leather pants in Berlin, but they're not wearing Lederhosen. That's a different thing again. And you know, when you think of big beers, for example, or when you think of pretzels, it's very much
Oktoberfest,
exactly. It's very much a Munich based thing. So Munich was very conscious of retaining that culture. I think for the city of Munich too, because of the fact that it was so identified with the Nazis for so long, that they were very conscious of restoring Bavarian culture, restoring the city to what it was previous to that era.
I would say I probably get some shit off Irish people, but it'd make more sense to English and Americans if I was to say Munich would be the Killarney of Germany,
whereby Killarney
is like the shillelagh and everyone's wearing green and they're top of the morning to you.
Yeah, very much.
And then going home and then cutting their arms with razor blades because they hate themselves for being so...
Plastic paddy.
And you know, the hats with the buckles and the fucking the white tights and all that shit. So they do that shit here in Munich.
They definitely do advance that kind of stereotype. And I mean, you do see it in touristy things as well. You know, I mean, the thing is too, but the people who come here, they also want to see it. You know, during Oktoberfest, for example, when I run tours, I run in Lederhosen. And I mean,
it works a treat.
People love it, you know.
How do they,
and you know, the thing is, and it's
how
good
do
for
they
me.
Feel?
With the girls, for example, that, I mean,
how do they
when
feel?
Female tour guides, when they run tours at Oktoberfest with the boobies hanging out, I mean, it goes down a treat.
Right.
It goes down an absolute treat, you know. And I mean, I've never seen a girl who didn't look good in a journal trip at all. But however, the locals, I mean,
do the lederhosen grab on your bits?
No, they're very comfortable. Oh yeah, they're very comfortable.
You're meant to wear them
commando.
You do. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Gordon, I would encourage you to get one, if only for the fact that you'll have a Halloween costume for the rest of your days.
Yeah.
Sorted.
We get
forever.
A pair.
Yeah, you could. They are. The thing is,
I spend a lot of time in my jogskin, I have to say. But when I'm editing and stuff like that, if they're comfortable enough. It's like lambskin. No, what is it? Like deer skin?
Hey, but listen, it's skin on skin. I know about you, but skin on skin always feels good for me.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Come here. So, yeah, enough tourism. We get into Hitler, because that's what we're all here for. So. On the tour that you brought us around, you're showing us some of the bigger sites that was associated with the Nazi regime. We're talking about the beer hall putsch. We're talking about, you know, Hitler standing up on chairs and giving these like wonderfully impassioned ululations of National Socialism, trying to unite all Germanic peoples of all types. And we can kind of hear in the modern day, like this word Nazi has been thrown around an awful lot. And I think it kind of cheapens and weakens what was happening. The ethos is probably still the same, which is we need to get all the people of the same type together to fuck all the other people off because we're the best.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start doing that, it ends up being a little bit...
Well, there's no...
A little bit dangerous.
When you go down that road, there's no positive end for it. I mean, once you establish that there is superior inferior peoples, then...
That the Jews don't do it because they only marry their own, and if you want to marry in, you gotta convert. Everybody likes to keep to their own, man. Do you know what I mean? It's not a good thing.
The thing is too, and I mean, I don't know.
When you're actively keeping to your own, but keeping other people down, the Untermensch and all this stuff.
I think it's important to realize too that Europe before World War II, and particularly before World War I, you have a series of kingdoms for the most part, right? But Europe is essentially a patchwork of nationalities. And, you know, the Germans were found all throughout Eastern Europe. They're even over as far as Kazakhstan as the Volga River. They were all, the big populations of Moldova. And that's just the Germans. You know, the Hungarians are also spread around. All these nationalities are.
Yeah.
Now we've got the nice, simple nation-state complex where everyone's in their nice little kind of package. And the Irish are different because we were an island by nature. But, you know, on the continent, everyone's in their own little kind of little area, right?
Yeah, and you get your little book with the coloured pages.
And you got your flag. And you watch your teams, you know, have successful, glorious failure at soccer tournaments and whatnot. But with regards to, like, you know, Hitler very much kind of seizes on the idea that people are different. And he very much tries to exacerbate that. And, you know, the Germans are the Germans, the Jews are the Jews, and the other nations. And, like, you have this line drawn, which basically says that the Slavs or the Eastern Europeans are a lesser people. And your Western Europeans, your French, your British, for example, the Irish, he actually had quite a bit of respect for Ireland. Because we fit into his view type of your kind of Nordic, Northern, Anglo-Saxon peoples.
But we also had our own indigenous culture, which is the thing that they liked.
We have a very strong culture,
Hitler was like, if you're willing to roll over on your culture, then you're obviously not strong enough to...
To warrant
survive.
Your own state,
or, well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if you're not going to stand up for your own history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we talked about the rebuilding of Munich and the perpetuation of Germanism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not kind of what everybody's doing? Like, Americans are all USA, USA. They celebrate, like, Paddy's Day in Trinidad and Tobago and, you know, the fucking the Spice Islands and shit.
Yeah.
Like, there's lads in Outer Mongolia is like, happy Paddy Day. Like, they know what Ireland is, and you wear green and you fucking kiss me, I'm Irish. And, like, that's a celebrated nationalistic endeavor that celebrates quintessential Irelandisms, like alcohol, having a fight, doing it. And it's kind of a negative stereotype in one way. It's good in another way because it's like it celebrates our ability to spread all over the world and enhance culture. And, like, we built the fucking railroads and we built New York. And Australia wouldn't be there only for the fact that we were fucking robbing and raping lads in Carlow. And it's like, get on that boat, you. And then they sent him to a fucking continent, Eden, paradise, just to be just riding and making more criminal babies.
Yeah.
Like, that's celebrating Ireland as a national entity.
But
so what's
also,
wrong with that?
But Ireland's also one of the few countries in the world.
Not that I'm a nationalist. I'm absolutely
not at all. But Ireland's also one of the few countries in the world where you have this kind of worldwide recognition and celebration of such a day. And Ireland's easy too because Ireland was neutral, because Ireland is this easy, like, oh, they drink beer, they all say top of the morning, like you said, they all live in, you know, they all is,
we never oppressed anybody.
We never oppressed anybody because we were oppressed ourselves for so long. So that's why I think Ireland's a little bit different, because, you know, you don't see countries celebrating, you know, there's very few countries with darker histories, we'll say, you know, and there's quite a few of them out there. You know, there's no one celebrates Belgium Day. And everyone loves waffles and chocolate, don't they? You know,
yeah, but
like,
when we were in Amsterdam, we were talking to those guys, and there's a lot of really rich people in Amsterdam who colluded with the Nazis, who, you know, actively took part in extricating the Jews from the city, who built their businesses and empires on the back of the fact that Jews were just taken up in the middle of the night and brought away, and then they took over their businesses, and now they're millionaires in the modern day, and there's no reparations, and there's
no acknowledgement,
and there's no, like, there are certain elements that I think people pick and choose about what happened with World War II and say, okay, we're going to vilify that bit, but this bit we're going to profit from.
But do you feel that Germany has been vilified because of the Nazi period?
Yeah, I think unfairly so. Yeah. I think that it wasn't all Germans. It wasn't, you know, it was a bunch of people that had a certain ideology that was allowed to flourish, and they got in, a small subset got into power, told everybody through really well-crafted and really like scientifically perfect methods, propagandized people. Yeah. Like they, we said in our Hitler and the occult episode, we talked about the fact that Hitler made it an imperative that every single German citizen had a radio.
Yeah.
And they'd play music over the radio.
Yeah.
But the music was only just to keep people entertained in between the messages of propaganda. Yeah. And now we still listen to radio as a, like, that wasn't a thing, you know.
Yeah.
And now we still listen to radio as a casual, you know, in America they didn't even have, like, they had one radio per house.
Yeah.
And you'd all sit around it and they'd have programmed thing. Nobody had personal radios. Nazi Germany was the first one to do that.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you see, like, post-war 1950s Americana where they're all like, driving in my automobile, and they fucking had the car radios on and they were listening to the tunes. Mm-hmm. Like, that didn't happen before for Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
And that was Hitler going, I need to have something that people want to listen to all the time, and whenever I have a message to give, they'll take it. Like, that's crazy that they would come up with that.
Yeah.
And then it'll be adopted by the very society that abhorred that.
Yeah.
Like, America hated Nazism and yet took over loads of their you know, ideologies, foibles, science, ethics, like ethos.
I think too as well, but I think, I mean, Germans had been a... Germans had also formed a lot of American ideas for a long time before 1945. I mean, a lot of the
worldwide ideas.
German thinkers, and the Germans really did dominate the thinking world for particularly the 19th century in particular. Sociology was founded in Germany. Yeah. I mean, psychiatry, genetics, for example, Mendel and the peas in the pod kind of idea. I mean, it all originated, granted, now he was from the Czech Republic, but he was also from the German-speaking part of the Czech Republic. So, I mean, the Germans are always very advanced in science, and I think that's why when America comes through during the war, that they see, and again, I don't know necessarily, I think there was aspects that were very Nazi that originated from them. I think there was also aspects that were simply traits of the German peoples that were then...
Like what?
Well, I mean... Because I mentioned earlier about the Prussian armies, right?
Yeah.
And about how they control the state and they control the government and they control the army. Now, for your average middle-class German person, they had to find other ways to socially be mobile. So they became obsessed with university, for example, right? So they had these couple of concepts like in Inwardlichkeit, in inwardness. The idea basically that to learn from yourself, from looking inwards, to look into yourself, see how you can better yourself, and then use that going forward in your life. And this was a huge part of German culture at the time, especially amongst the middle classes, as a way of basically bettering themselves, because they didn't have a chance to be socially mobile and attain the top job. So they felt like by bettering ourselves as a person, we can then better ourselves in society. They also had the Bildung idea, and very much the idea of learning a craft and dedicating yourself to it. And this is actually seen in German culture to this day, where if you go off an apprenticeship, there's over 300 specific apprenticeships that you can get within the German education system.
Wow.
And these are all fully trained, fully legally recognized, pretty much worldwide.
Now, what are we talking about, like apprenticeships?
So let's say, for example, like...
In Ireland, you're like...
In Ireland, plumber, carpenter, exactly. Yeah. So like, let's say, for example, let's say related to a stage, right? So if you want to be a light technician, that's a specialized apprenticeship of its own. If you want to be a carpenter related to stage work, that is a more focused aspect of carpentry. Now, you'll be doing a general carpentry Ausbildung, as they call it in Germany, but you could focus on something more specific to that, in essentially how to, for example, build stages to the exact requirements, more so differentiating yourself from someone who builds a factory or builds a house. You know what I mean? And this is just to give you an example. So, I mean, you have a lot of specialization within Germany. So in Ireland, for example, I mean, if you do pass subjects all the way through, I mean, it's I wouldn't say it's a death sentence, but it's you're very limited, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in Germany, they kind of recognize that
the other intelligence,
academia is not for you, and you can really find your own path in life. Now, to bring this round to where we were talking about earlier on with Hitler and everything else, I think that there was quite a few concepts that were advanced by the Nazis, and I think when America comes through too, I mean, every country that's ever conquered another country has also taken little bits of their culture back home with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a part of history. You know, it's not just, you're not just looting from...
Look at England.
Yeah. I mean, completely. You're not just looting from a physical perspective, but also from a metaphorical perspective. Yeah. In like, what aspects of these cultures can we reclaim as our own? I mean, this is seen, for example, you know, with the Greeks.
Yeah.
The Greeks and the Romans. You know, the Romans conquered Greece. And what did they come back with? They come back with all the Greek culture in the world. And Greek culture essentially becomes Roman culture, becomes bastardized over the course of time. So I think with America, I mean, this was to be expected. I mean, there is culture wars often as much as there is physical wars.
I don't think there's even like a cultural aspect. Like we're talking about, if you're talking about like culture and your inward thinking and your progressivism when it comes to like how to deal with certain aspects of personality or identity or sexuality, like the Frankfurt School and the Jews that were driven out of a National Socialist mm-hmm. Germany in the mm-hmm. 30s that went to America as a safe haven for thinkers. Those guys built a whole society through the institutions, and not unlike, you know, I guess we talked about the Wannsee Conference, like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is the mm-hmm. document that they scraped up. Now I'm saying this in a German beer garden, and you're it's highly illegal to talk about that shit around here, but I think that a reputedly fake document like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and something like the accusations put against these thinkers from the Frankfurt School that they wanted to have, and it's written down, but who knows who fucking wrote it down, that they wanted to have a long march through the universities to change American culture and American society for the better, in their opinion.
Yeah.
There seems to be another military, industrial, I guess ethical and societal, like pop culture or whatever. Those four elements after 1945 were taken into American culture, and they were massively blown up using Bernays, like methods of sales. And you know, like Freudian psychological yep. selling techniques yeah. and all this kind of stuff. So like loads of German influence, loads of German scientists, like physically were plucked, scientists and engineers plucked from a Nazi regime and yep. implanted in America. Like it's more than just, you know, you're bringing home a few.
Exchange,
you're bringing home a few old slave women and they sing a song while you're raping them and they're doing the washing, you know, in the fucking side of the river.
Yeah.
And they're all like, "Oh, this is a song for my home country. Don't go too hard." And you know, like that's a small little thing. But these are actual like high up dudes that were inducted into the government who would set forward a whole lot of things in motion that leave us with stuff like NASA
that were completely
made by Nazis.
Yeah.
Like it seems. It seems like Munich as a town wants to go back to the way it was before celebrate its old Germanic roots.
It does.
Forget about Nazism,
very much
but
so.
Like disregard the bad parts of it.
I think you've actually hit the nail on the head there. And I think it is a problem that Munich has quite a bit as a city, is acknowledging and recognizing the whole period and trying to find the right balance between moving on as a modern day city and also recognizing the role that was played.
Because America doesn't recognize the role that was played by Nazis in their culture or history in any way whatsoever.
Because it suits the association
with that.
Mm-hmm. Tell them all about it, the conspiracy guys.
Tell us about some of the things that we talked about on the tour, because I saw some really interesting stuff with Hitler's early history, like mm-hmm. pre-Czechoslovakia, like pre the Lebensraum push. We were talking about his first public speaking engagements. Mm-hmm. He hit the beer hall putsch, and then the creation of like the headquarters for the SS and all this kind of stuff. Tell us about some of the things that we might see on the tour if we have a chance.
So I mean, and the specific focus that I like to talk about on tour is very much the kind of the early days, because that's the bit that people don't have a whole lot of let's say recognition or understanding of, and particularly like, you know, how it kind of came to be, or even his life before that.
A lot of people think that he was just pulling the guts out of himself, painting pictures of Alsatians with one testicle like, you know, not being able to get the ride and just being a little withered handed fucking strange mustache one bald cunt.
I mean, he is it comes about slowly. I mean, he essentially, after World War One, I mean, he served in World War One and did quite well for himself. And it was also the first period in his life when he's successful at something. because up until that point, up until he joins World War One, he's 25 years of age. He's a failed painter. He's a bum. For want of a better phrase, he's essentially a bum.
Yeah.
You know, he's not an educated.
You're saying he lived in Vienna, he lived in
homeless shelters. You know, he was down the bottom of society. And when he gets to the top as well, of course, he feels like it's vindication. He feels like that he was sent from God. It was providence, you know, and it very much fuels him, this kind of idea. But
cocaine will do that to you.
Cocaine will do it to you. That will. It will make you feel really good about yourself.
I heard he was mad on amphetamines.
He was mad, but I think that was so. The amphetamine itself was Pervitin. And Pervitin was actually, it's methamphetamine basically. And it was actually part of the rations of your German army, German Air Force, German soldiers had.
He got hooked up on it in World War One, right?
There is a thought. Now, I think it very much became, it was more so towards the later years.
Okay.
I don't think, for example, when he's coming to power, I don't think he's hooked on it. Now, right, Hermann right. Göring was actually, Hermann Göring, and this is a great story. Hermann Göring during the beer hall putsch, he got shot in the testicle. And he lost the testicle. And he became addicted to morphine, which is why Göring actually disappears from the party from 23 till about 27, because he spends those years in Vienna, in Austria, in northern Austria, up in the mountains, essentially nursing his ball and nursing himself. And kind of, he's actually addicted to morphine for 20 years, which is funny because then the Americans get him off with a sugar-based solution. Oh, he actually loses a lot of weight once he gets off of morphine,
yeah.
Which again is the opposite of what you'd expect from what my associates tell me. But
when you're in Austria, you're eating it. There's a lot of cakes.
There's a lot of areas, a lot of strudel to be eaten, isn't
there? Yeah, yeah.
No, but however.
Sacker tort.
Kaiser Schmarrn, which is a good one.
Love it.
Yeah, Emperor's Bullshit, as it's literally translated as. But I think he had a doctor, kind of a quack doctor called Theodore Morel, who I think definitely, I couldn't tell you what year it was exactly, but I think it was probably, I reckon it was in probably towards the start of the war. 39-40, he starts getting dosed up. Now, I'm saying that actually cocaine was a very common drug, particularly amongst Victorian England in the latter part of the 19th century. It was an eye remedy, actually
yeah.
An eye medication, so that was useful.
He used to put it in bottles of Coke in America and buy it for 5 cents.
That's why it's called Coca-Cola.
Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
So
now,
do you think, just because I lose it if I don't say it,
yeah.
When we were talking earlier on, when you were talking earlier on, but I was asking you questions, nine. We were talking about Hitler being kind of guided when he started in the party. We're talking mm-hmm. about how he got into it. He was in the party. He was guided. His leadership and all this stuff. But coming towards like the early to mid 30s, he was the top dog.
Oh, he was the top dog from the late 20s onwards. He brought himself into a position, and this is a solid, you know, 6 years before he comes to power. He establishes a position where he is the unquestioned leader of the party.
Mm.
And the party is Hitler, Hitler is the party. You know, there isn't that. That's why, for example, you know, there was never anybody trying to challenge him from within.
So what I'm saying is, because we talk about that more in a second, but just on the point of him being dosed up,
mm-hmm.
do you think that he started from nothing and overtook all of these lads, even got the leader of the Nazi party voted out and him voted
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
like within 2 years
yeah
and then he went on to build this whole big empire, massive army in contravenience of the Treaty of Versailles and all this other stuff. He was making like hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in the army, and then the crew he had around him, you know, were like, okay, this guy is class, but he's fucking mad, so we have to maybe like deactivate him a small bit and then like dose him up with a load of drugs and then tell him he's great, but then tell him some ideas and then let him think that they're his ideas, so they kind of like maybe delegitimize him a little bit by having him on meth.
Absolutely. I think the most fascinating aspect of the Third Reich for me is the Battle of No. 2, because it was constantly in flux.
Mm.
No, it was Hess for a while.
Yeah.
And then it was Göring, and then
Rudolf Hess parachuted into fucking Scotland.
But there's a claim actually that he'd been talking to Churchill beforehand.
Yes,
he and that Churchill essentially sat in the back, you know.
Yeah.
Which I honestly, I'd be inclined to believe it.
In our Aleister Crowley episode, we found out what it actually was Aleister Crowley and Rudolf Hess were both like high magicians and were fighting each other, and then Crowley told Churchill to say to Hess, if you come to Scotland, the whole war will be decided on a magic battle between you and Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
And Hess was like, yeah, I'll take it. And he parachuted in a suit, a linen suit with loads of mad symbols on it. And then they were just caught and Aleister Crowley was like, you fucking dog. And Hess was like, but you said we would battle like in the Hogwarts. And it's like, no, you're caught now. Give us all your secrets.
Yeah, you're fucked.
Or we pull your fucking toenails.
Yeah.
Like, that's genius.
It was genius. It was
hilarious.
Genius. But he was worst of all for it too, you know.
Yeah.
But you have
the Battle for No. 2, sorry.
The Battle for No. 2. I mean, it really, and of course the funny thing is, The man who wins it at the end is Martin Bormann. But by the time he wins, it's a poison chalice.
He got handed a dead dog. Yeah,
he did. He did. But I mean, he was probably one of the most ruthless of them all. I think you're definitely onto something there when you talk about, you know, I think the manipulation of Hitler from the underlings is something that does happen once you get towards the war, and once Hitler's, I think it's especially pronounced from 41 onwards, once the kind of veil of invincibility disappears, you know, because in France, yeah. I mean, like, you look at the first 2 years of the war, I mean, they swept all before them.
Yeah.
And they literally did.
Unchallenged.
Unchallenged. But of course, this is the problem. It was unchallenged. You know, when Hitler takes over, they have an army of 100,000. Now, granted, he's gonna repeal the Treaty of Versailles in every way, shape, or form, but when he goes into the Saarland, when he goes into the Rhineland, and he takes over the coal fields and he takes over the steelworks again, no one challenges him.
Yeah.
When he goes to the Sudetenland, and they acquiesce and they basically allow him to have Sudetenland, and you have the whole peace for our time and the waving of the Pacific paper.
But did they not think that was just the next lads coming down the line after being passed from Billy to Jack?
But the thing is, they would have, if they had stood up to him, Hitler didn't have the capability at that stage to fight back.
No, but like, he was faking until he was making it.
He was allowed to fake it. And the problem is as well, I think the biggest player in all of that period is definitely America. Because America in 1919 is, I mean, Woodrow Wilson comes over to Europe and he dictates what he wants.
Yeah.
And they are very much, they're the number one power in the world. They adopt a policy of isolationism, and they just say to let you figure it out for yourself. And that, in one of the ways, it is one of the factors that does allow the Nazi party and the regime and everything else that comes afterwards to kind of come together. Because of the fact that they're not willing to step into the breach, which is rather unlike America. And it's definitely a lesson that they learned from.
Don't tell Adolf the babysitter's dead kind of thing.
And when you look at the reaction after World War II, where America was made a very conscious effort to interfere. Interfere is not quite the right word, but yeah. make sure that it turned out as they wanted, you know? Which is your...
Well, they wanted to make the money, man.
As the number world power, that's your right.
Was that guy at the back of a bar fight going like, oh yeah, just graze off me so I'll have an excuse to get in and jump in. And they made the most money. Like America wouldn't be successful as it is today without joining in World War II. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, totally, yeah.
And knowing that Germany started this thing, England can't keep it under control, France rolled over, and if we don't come and take it over, Germany's going to take over industry, we're going to have mm-hmm. biggest coal production, they're going to have biggest steel production, like good, clean coal, great steel, huge. And they didn't want that, so they were like, now we got to take these guys down.
Totally.
And then we'll take all their fucking gold and all the shit.
And their scientists and their rocket makers.
Not wanting to try and like vilify America as much as I am, but like, I think there's two culprits in that
But
war,
I mentioned this in the tour today, and yeah. I said like, and in fairness, the Second World War is one of the last wars where we've clearly identified the good and bad side. Mm. But, and I mentioned there's a lot of gray area.
The rest of them have been America attacking people.
Well, in many ways, right? In many ways. Now, the big gray area is...
But who did the Nazis not like? Communists.
Communists.
Who does the Americans not like anymore after World War II?
They never like communists either. Totally.
Korea, Vietnam, mm-hmm. fucking...
Joe McCarthy.
Like, this shit yeah. is textbook. Like, when you look at it on paper, all, like, in two columns, apples for apples, it's fucking Nazis that run America, and they're still on the same mission statement.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I think in many ways they are. Now... America does learn a lot of lessons from the aftermath after World War One and after the aftermath after World War Two.
Yeah.
And they kind of realize that, like, listen, if we're going to become the number one nation in the world, which they were at that stage, then you essentially have to throw your considerable weight around.
Yeah.
And they did that. And I mean, I think with the spoils of war, I think there's certain, you know, like the. Mentioned this on tour, you know, the experiments that were conducted on the POWs, yes, and in the extermination concentration camps, you know, this material was never thrown away. It was very much kept in use, and it was a lot of what we know worldwide about hypothermia and G-forces and heat and cold on the body is directly related from this, because you can do it on rats all you want, but I mean, it's not going to be the same results as
everything
we
know about sewing one person
yeah.
to another person against their will.
Yeah.
Comes from that's really useful science,
and the Japanese as well, and exactly. It's really useful science. If you're as moralistic as you want to portray, then theoretically you would have burnt all that material.
Yeah,
but that doesn't happen, you know.
Yeah,
and that's the gray area, and that's one of the gray areas, you know.
Can you tell us before we go a little bit about the beer hall putsch and the rise? Because we're going to do for those conspiracy guys, we're going to do a 6-part World War II
mm-hmm.
kind of a ramble down history lane.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important thing that people didn't know. You gave us a real good rendition of what happened. People don't know how, not influential, but like how performative and how, what's the word I'm looking for Hitler? Like how enigmatic, charismatic, yeah. How powerful he was as an orator. Mm-hmm. Like, tell us a little bit about
He had the gift. I mean, he just, and the funny thing is that he was quite an introvert by nature. He didn't have a whole lot of friends. He read voraciously. I mean, he read everything he could about a topic. I mean, he was very dogmatic and determined about, you know, educating himself personally on as much as he could. But he wasn't the kind of fellow who went down to the beer garden and had 3-4 beers and met friends and had a great night. You know, he finished his day's work. He went home. First of all, he didn't drink to begin with. He also didn't smoke, and he was also vegetarian. Now, that explains a lot. But
he's a straight edger.
He was a straight edger. He was a very straight edger, right?
Jesus.
Yeah, he wouldn't think it. And he was a Mormon. No, he wasn't a Mormon. But
he was a secret Jehovah's Witness. What did he have against those guys? Like, I don't like the way they come knocking on your door when you don't want them. Okay, put them to the camp. Go.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Okay, Adolf, are we going to ban all doors? No, just get rid of all the doors.
No, just Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
But when he gets on stage, when he stands in front of the people, his real gift, especially in the early days, I mean, you know, once he gets settled into power, it's a repeat of everything that's come before it. I mean, it's just, you know, everything he does in the early days is an experiment to see what works, what doesn't work. So by the time he comes to power in 33, I mean, it's a well-oiled process. Like, he knows how to bring him up, what to bring him down. He brings him on the roller coaster of that is his speech. But
You were saying in the early days he had the political and economic situation in Germany after World War One. There was a vacuum there for somebody with a cult of personality.
Absolutely.
And we had a parallel thing in Russia with the 1905 and then the 1917 revolution, mm-hmm. where a communist party led by a godlike figure, again, some kind of deity figure in the body of Ulyanov Lenin.
Yeah.
He was coming in, speaking to thousands of people at a time. In Ireland, even at the same time, we had the Michael Collinses and the Jim Larkins. It was a time of orators.
It was a time
of public speaking.
Because there was a lack of media. I mean, what did you have? You had newsreels, barely, in 1922, and you had newspapers.
I think
Hitler's gift, essentially, was to take, you know, you have a huge amount of military-trained men who come back after World War One, and they're bitter, and they're disenfranchised, and they're disillusioned. And they come back with no job opportunities, hyperinflation, with no money whatsoever. And Hitler's ability, his great ability in this period was to basically explain to them why they felt the way that they felt. And to put it in words as to the reason I feel so upset. And he could tell you it was the Treaty of Versailles, it was the Jews and the communists, you know, stabbing the back theory and the running of Germany, it was the Weimar Republic. It was X,
Bad
Y, and Z.
Bad dudes on both sides coming over here, taking your jobs. You can see the parallels.
Yeah, you can.
People say like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But at the time it was totally acceptable. It was encouraged even.
It was an era of polarization, wasn't it?
Mm.
You know, you have you know, it's also the communists have first case worldwide if they come to power within a couple of years. And that was a part of the problem too in Germany. After the war you have the Spartacus Revolution of Berlin, you have the Munich Soviet, which is, they're both communist revolutions which took place in the immediate aftermath of the World War One in Berlin and Munich. Now they are eventually quashed, and granted, both revolutions, they did some pretty bad things. You know, they shot people without trial, and but in saying that, I mean, I'm sure the right wingers would have done the exact same thing in the same circumstances. But you have this polarization within Germany in particular, and you have this massive left-right divide, and you have a very weak center. And of course, this eventually leads to the fall of the Weimar Republic and Hitler coming to power. And that was actually his genius.
The middle class collapses.
Well, he's the middle class collapse. And he's also aware of the problem, the flaw within German democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Germany nowadays, if you want to take your seats in parliament, you have to get a percentage of the vote, which is 5%. So you can't just run as an independent or run.
Yeah.
And you know, you have to basically get a vote. And the reason was, in Ireland, granted, it's the same way. So like, I can run on my own, I win and I win, right? But in Ireland, it's small enough that it's not an issue. But in Germany, at the year of Weimar Republic, you could have 50 parties in a parliament of 500-600 people. And you're never going to have a majority government.
We were told that in the Netherlands as well. And we were talking to people in Berlin, where there's, in all of these countries in Europe, there's these huge rainbow coalitions of...
Mm-hmm.
different part. Like in Ireland, it's two parties.
It is, and they're both the fucking
same. They're both the fucking same people. Yeah. One of them just doesn't believe that Mary is a virgin or something like that. There's some one of those stupid rules. But like most of the time, it's a two-party system. America's a two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
England, pretty much a two-party system. But in Europe, they have these rainbow coalitions that have a lot of concessions that they have to make to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to make it an awful lot more balanced and an awful lot less polarized.
Yeah.
Now, there's a rise of the right in Germany. This is in direct response to Merkel's kind of open door policies, which is a direct response to Germany's guilt over,
exactly.
you know, Fugees and people coming into to Germany like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And then getting like turfed out and gassed.
Yeah.
And it seems to be like
it's that legacy of guilt, isn't it?
Exactly.
You know,
but,
and it just keeps
But is it any
again.
Good? Like guilt in an individual is a very dangerous emotion.
It very much so.
Do you know, like the whole thing about going to therapy or fucking whatever you're doing, like taking mad drugs or, you know, fucking even just talking with your mates and having a beer and trying to alleviate guilt from yourself. Because like, you know, nothing is really anybody's, like, nothing that happens to you is your fault or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, how is it allowed to be tolerated as a country's mentality?
So I think it is changing. It is changing at the moment, you know, because you have this generation that have come of age now in the last 5-10 years that don't even have grandparents who were from that era. And
right.
I think the legacy guilt was, I wouldn't say it was a good thing, but I think it was understandable and probably a necessary evil in the first 25, 30 years.
Because it was raw.
After. But it was raw. But like, I mean, you also...
It's on the wall in Auschwitz, man. That if we don't... this is obviously paraphrasing because I haven't got the wall in front of me. But it's like, if we don't deal with the mistakes of the past, we're forced to repeat them.
Yeah.
So like, if these people are forgetting, and then they're looking at a lad on YouTube who says that like, fucking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a dirty socialist and she needs to fuck off.
Yeah.
They're like, you're literally a Nazi. And it's like, he has a clue about what the fuck you're talking about. Yeah. And yet it's still gone to nationalism versus socialism.
Yeah.
It's still at that binary opposition.
But the thing is this, you look at Europe, most of Europe is socialist. Insofar as
operationally socialist.
Operationally, insofar as like, what their aims were after 45, the vast majority of them have been achieved.
Yeah.
You know? So when you say
socialism, we're talking about
universal healthcare,
education
for all, education policy, a kindergarten, for example, that's essentially free for all, and that is socialism. You know, I think in America, for example, socialism gets misconstrued with communism.
Yeah, well, they're some of the shit they're talking about is borderline communism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's tax billionaires like 90% of their income. It's like, yeah, why don't you just put them up on a fucking wall and shoot them all and then just seize their assets, you fucking Stalinist cunts or whatever.
But at the same time, you have a situation like you have in Ireland where you have Apple who
don't pay taxes. Yeah.
You know, so I think again, there has to be, again, it's like many things in life, there has to be a balance sought between them.
Do you think there's a vacuum now at the moment similar to post-World War One politics where the middle class is being dissolved?
Yeah.
A lot of people are feeling disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm.
They're working their fucking hole off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not walking to the shop with a wheelbarrow full of Reichmarks to buy a loaf of bread. But they're watching other people getting like little bits of this, little bits of that. And, you know, a lot of people on credit, driving cars that they maybe can't afford, living life, being on Instagram. And a lot of people feel disenfranchised and they're looking for someone who's real talking.
They do.
Telling them their problems like Hitler did in the beer hall, being like, I know how you feel. This is really shitty. You know, pick yourself up.
But we will make it better. Yeah.
Dust yourself off. Throw the right hand in the air like you just don't care. And I think that there's a lot of parallels in society which drives people to look at Donald Trump, who I don't support, neither decry. They look at Donald Trump, he is literally Hitler. What he's doing is going out and doing what Adolf did in those early National Socialist meetings, which is, I'm talking to the people, I'm telling them what they think is wrong, I'm telling them how I'm going to fix it, and he's actually delivering. He's actually doing stuff. So people are feeling that early 20s Germany vibe, and then a magic man comes along.
And
with flyaway hair, who says the right thing, and then throws in a tremendous or whatever every so often, And they're like, he's brilliant. And now 3.5 years later, he's delivering on a load of stuff. People are like, he's literally Hitler. There has been like investigations and all this kind of stuff against him to try and oust him. Like, I don't want to say Hitler had the right idea, but if he was left alone and he wasn't surrounded by all these lads, they're like, let's make a load of camps and fucking get rid of Jews. Like, if there was all those people that didn't come around and pump him full of meth and do all that stuff, he, like you said, he was vegetarian, he outlawed tobacco, he banned fox hunting, he was very, progressive.
But the problem was with Hitler was that he some of his ideas were batshit crazy.
Yeah, of course.
I mean that from a societal aspect. So one of the things he wanted to do was the Volkswagen. He wanted to offer every citizen in Germany a Volkswagen that would cost 1,000 Reichmarks. The problem was the true value of the Volkswagen was about 10,000 Reichmarks. And right around 1938, the Nazi number crunchers got in a room and they said to themselves, fuck, if we sell 60 million of these Volkswagens at a fucking 9,000 Reichmark loss, it's going to bankrupt us.
It was just print more money.
The printing more money would have worked because they'd have taken over new states and looted everything else. But
Now what America's doing with the Federal Reserve.
Yeah,
they don't have the gold to back it up. And they're like, I just want to build billions of dollars worth of weapons and fucking a $9 billion plane every 4 days. So let's just make more money. What happens when people come and try to cash out the money? Just tell them we have more.
Yeah. We'll talk about later on.
Like, it's just like it continued on, mm-hmm. but just succeeded.
Yeah.
Rather than being stopped. And the people it was stopped by were the people that are succeeding and doing it mm-hmm. now.
And I think
I'm maybe like hedging you down a thing to make you say something that you don't want to say. But like, I know Hitler didn't have the right idea.
Yeah.
I know. We're looking at each other's eyes right now. No glasses. Yeah. I know that. But what I'm saying is the parallels between what was happening then, disenfranchised people, and now they're looking for someone who's going to come.
Well, I think the problem is you have a vortex, you have a lack of calm, stable leadership.
Yeah.
And Angela Merkel is really the glue that's kept. I mean,
she's shaking like a shitting dog, boss.
No, I wouldn't say
she is not able.
I wouldn't say she's the glue that's kept Germany together.
No.
But she's definitely like she's actually probably been the glue that's kept the EU together.
I think so.
Very much so, especially with the Greek crisis and everything else.
But why bother keep the EU together if it's a failed project? Like it's a failed stage. You know?
I think the EU has finally realized the need to reform.
Yeah.
But I don't think the EU is a failed state either.
No, what I'm saying is that she has declared herself the queen of the EU. She has very much so.
I don't think Merkel is necessarily an ambitious person who's trying to make herself out to be greater than she is.
No,
I think that she's been able to read the tea leaves and realize that there's no one else who's going to step up to the plate. So if she ain't going to do it, you're going to have the EU will essentially become a circus with no P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
And she's very much the P.T. Barnum of the EU right now. And I think you have a lack of stable leadership across the world.
Macron tried to do it about 3 years ago. He tried to step up and take over because Merkel was like, maybe I will, maybe I won't. She wasn't really solid on it. Probably knew that some health issues were coming down the line.
Yeah.
And now she's out, like she's standing in a fucking gulag shaking in front of everybody. Macron knew that he'd be facing off against Donald Trump. He knew that he had Trudeau in his back pocket. The two lads were buddy-buddy. And whenever they meet Trump, Macron would be like, you know, the cool lad in school who wears a jacket with the letter on it. And he'd be like, oh, here comes Donald.
And the tassels, right?
And all the way down. And like a fucking a thumb ring or whatever. He's like, here comes Donald. Look at, go to put out your hand. And then at the last second when he goes to shake your hand, go like this and run it through your ear. That's the cool guy's move. Like, that's what he was doing, right?
Yeah.
And then Donald is like, okay, fuck all y'all. And now Macron is being ousted by his people. They're burning the fucking streets down. The French are the best at protesting. Like I said, Merkel is on the way out. She's already seceded.
I think she is.
Handed back her power. And I don't think she'd be Chancellor of Germany for much longer.
No,
so that shit is falling apart.
It is, very
and
much so.
Visibly.
And who's going to step up?
Visibly, our straw-haired Hitler wannabe, that people are like, literally Hitler, like he's doing well. Americans are doing real well. Everybody's happy out, pretty much. For the most part.
Yeah.
Economically, for the most part.
Well, I think the key difference is, I think,
is this a beer hall putsch? Like, has there been the push forward? The support is there now. He will go back in 2020, Donald.
Mm-hmm.
Like, was 2016...
Because the good times are around.
Was 2016 the beer hall putsch?
It could well have been. I mean, I think the difference between Trump and Hitler is that I think Trump, Hitler had a lot more control of everything than Trump has right now.
Yeah.
Hitler, I mean, Hitler was so good, guys. He was so good. He didn't even need to give orders. Like, they had a concept with Hitler, which was called working towards the Führer, where essentially everyone knew what his beliefs were, and you didn't have to. You had a, the reason the Nazis were so ruthless is because if you had an issue, let's say for example, you're Himmler and I'm Goering, right? And I go and I say, oh, Himmler pissed on my cornflakes this morning and we've had a falling out. Hitler would go and he'd say, do something about it. Show me why you're stronger. So you have a situation that develops where everyone is essentially, they don't need to explicitly told what to do. They're all there for the advancement of Hitler's view or Hitler's idea. Yeah. And I think as long as you were on mission, you could do whatever you wanted to do. You didn't even need to ask for permission. You didn't need to go towards him. Whereas I think with Trump, I think there is definitely puppet stringers in the back.
Just a huge pushback.
Huge.
What Trump did in The Apprentice.
It was actually quite like what Trump did. Actually, you're quite right in that regard. It is very much like what he's a special guest here, Claire. It was very similar to what he did in The Apprentice. Absolutely.
I'm saying who's saying he's not doing that now?
He started off with a cabinet of people who weren't working towards Donald,
and he was like, Bannon, do as you're told, or you're gone. You're not doing it. You're gone.
Yeah.
Hey, Jeff Sessions. Yeah, you gonna do that thing? You gonna do it, Jeff? Little Jeffy. You gonna do it, Jeff? No? Hit the bricks, Jeff. Like, everybody in his cabinet was fired within the first 6 months.
Easily, right?
Because he can't send them to a Dachau. Yeah. There's no, like, Dachau in North Carolina where you can just process people who don't like Donald Trump. But he did that, like, politically, sociologically, like, culturally, made those people, like, unwanted, pushed them away. I'm not saying Trump is Hitler. But I'm saying that there's a vacuum of...
It's a huge
like,
vacuum.
From
a
what
huge
you
vacuum.
Taught me today about how Hitler jumped in,
took
over a party from the dude who invented it within 2 years, and then fucking unified and ununified. Like, he's like Mance Rayder. Did you watch Game of Thrones?
He's the
fucking Mance Rayder of all the Warren cunts in Germany just coming together going like, come on, lads, we're going to go over the wall. And it fucked everybody up.
Yeah.
And he had everybody behind him except that one lad in that picture that crossed his arms when everyone's doing the salute.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm afraid to do the salute as a joke because it's illegal here.
Yeah.
Some lad, what did you say? Got fined 6,000
euros.
Yeah, my hands are in my pockets.
Yeah.
That's fuck, I can't afford that shit. But what I'm saying is, like, Hitler was really, really good at what he did.
He's very good, yeah. But he was canny. He was canny in a way that I don't know if you'll Trump is canny. I mean, I think Trump is canny-ish, but I think, like, I think a lot of times with Trump, for example, I think he falls into things. He realizes it works because it just happens to work. And he's like, oh, Jesus, great. Fuck it. I'll use that in the future. Yeah. Wonderful, you know?
He doesn't push too hard for things.
Totally, no. He's not going in there with like, right, I'll try this. If that doesn't work, I'll try that. You know, I think that...
I couldn't imagine Kim Kardashian advising Hitler.
No.
On anything.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
No.
Number one, she's Armenian, so she's under mention.
It's like, no, the Indo-European language, she probably would have been okay.
Yeah.
She wasn't Slavish.
I don't know.
I mean, like the Greeks, for example. You know,
Pre-plastic surgery, she looked a bit savage. Afterwards, now she's very European. It's such an interesting time in Hitler's life. That young time when he was baller. He was like cocaine attitude, big boots, and fucking fuck you. Like, I really...
But in a way, it's an example of what you can achieve. If you just say, you know what, fuck it, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And who's going to stop me? Unless someone actually makes a conscious effort to stop you. Then you can kind of get away with anything. You know, I mean, the lessons we can learn from it is that, like, if you go unchecked, like, if no one ever says to you in your life that, you know, maybe you should do it differently or maybe this isn't the best thing for you, and if you totally believe in everything that you do is leading you to a higher plane, that's exactly what Hitler did.
We talked about Kanye West.
Yeah, the exact same, you know?
Like, that mentality.
It's a mentality. It doesn't necessarily turn you into a
Steve
tyrant,
Jobs.
Into a murderer, but, like, it turns you into an arsehole. That's what it does do.
Yeah.
You know, or at least a narcissist anyway.
But arseholes get stuff. We all know that.
They do, yeah. Yeah, they do plenty.
Do you know?
Yeah.
We've all gone through our mid to late teens with our dicks unsucked, like waiting for arseholes to get out of the way. But the thing is, arseholes don't get out of the way. They stand on the chair.
They do.
They shout stuff.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, something, and they get their dicks out. Something like
that. Yeah, and then perverting, and then...
We'll make a soundbite out of that. That's like a poet. That's like a t-shirt. We'll figure it out. So we're running out of time here, and the beer garden is filling up. The sun is setting, and Munich's getting ready for the nighttime. So, Ken, I just want to ask you, where can people find you? where can they hire you to talk words while they follow you around the town? Mm-hmm. Have you got a website? Is there social
media? I haven't got a website. I have.
Okay. We work on that.
We're working on that. So it is my first year going freelance this year, and it's gone really well. The best way to contact me is probably go through email, and you'll be looking at kevylong@hotmail.com. That's K-E-V-Y, kevylong@hotmail.com is probably the best way to contact me. We're going to be working on the social media influence in the autumn. Once we have a little bit more free time than what we've had in the summertime. But I got to say, for myself personally, yeah, I would love to, if someone got in touch with me, if you enjoyed it, please don't hesitate to get in touch. And what I want to say as well for myself, Gordon, it's been an absolute pleasure to be talking to you. Absolutely. It's been a wonderful surprise to me.
I found your first tour time, while having a shite this morning.
Did you?
I was like, magic. This looks cool, click. And now, here we go, from squeezing one out to
here we are.
Here we are.
Enjoying a beer and an Olesis hangout.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I got to say for myself as well, it's been the first time I've done something like this, and I've very much enjoyed it.
So when's the podcast coming out?
The podcast is going to be coming out on the 9th of November.
I'm spreading around fucking podcasts like AIDS, man. People are like, yeah, I did your podcast. It's fucking easy. I'm doing one now. So kevylong@hotmail.com, kevylong@hotmail.com. And you also do like tours.
So I do tours. I do tours around Munich and around parts of Bavaria as well. So if you are coming to Munich and you would like to give me a call, I'd be more than happy to take you on a private tour for a princely fee or a duke's fee at least. But no, in all seriousness, yeah, do please let us know, because there's an awful lot of history in this city, and I think it's been one of the center points of Europe, particularly the 20th century, and even almost today. I mean, it's one of the wealthiest cities in Europe is Munich, and it's been a good city to me. And there is also, one thing I would say as well, outside of the Third Reich element, there's also a lot of wonderful history that's away from
that. I was
just
going to ask you.
Because there is, the Bavarian history is also quite interesting. And what's also fascinating to
the
Ludwig's
city. One and
two. Well, you have the Ludwig's one and two.
Ludwig Harder.
And there was a three. But also as a modern day city, it's been a very good city to me, and I do like to kind of broadcast that on tour. We took on a tour which was very Third Reich orientated, but
I want a man to tell me about Hitler. Click. Loop.
And then I turned up.
Yeah.
Some random fucker from the west of Ireland. Yeah. Oh, Jesus, what would he know? But no, it's been an absolute pleasure to be on board.
And this is one of the traveling podcasts or swapcasts that we're doing for this TCG TV Europe expedition. So keep your ear out and your eye out. If you want to see some of the videos or anything else that's coming up from this little endeavor, you can go to patreon.com/thoseconspiracyguys and see all the videos and stuff like that. I'm doing a live show in London in Bush Hall on the 6th of October. The link for the tickets will be in the description below. If you're in London and you want to come and see me and slap hands and say hi, I'll be doing an hour of a bit of crack and banter presentation. We're going to have a guest for another hour and then a Q&A at the end, so you can ask me all the hard questions, like did Hitler have the right idea. I won't give you the answer now because I don't want to spoil it. And I'm also doing a gig in the Cork Podcast Festival that was just announced today. It's on the 12th of October. The tickets will be released very soon. I put them into the description below, but Cork Podcast Festival is happening all over that weekend, the 10th, 11th, 12th, and I think 13th of October. So if you're in anywhere around the southwest of Ireland, or, you know, if you want to have a trip, there's loads of affordable accommodation and stuff down in Cork. If you want to come down and see some of the bigger acts, I'll have a list and stuff for you later on. But all that leaves me to do is say thanks very much, Kevin Long, from all the way from München in Germany. And it was a serendipitous and very pleasant meeting. And now we're going to have some beers.
Likewise, Gordon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.